We're going to move on to our next speaker, and then we'll have a break. It's my pleasure to welcome Bob Hendel, who is the Director of Cardiac Imaging and Outpatient Cardiology at the University of Miami in Florida. And he'll spend some time talking about the appropriateness criteria. It's now been out a few years that it'll be time that it'll start creeping into the boards. This is the first year that we've added it onto the curriculum, so it's a chance to start thinking that the questions may start appearing to start thinking about the cost effectiveness and when things are appropriate. So it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Bob Hendel.
Thank you very much, Donna. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I see everyone's heading for the exits. I know that that tends to generate, when you say appropriate use, everyone floods out and this and that. The reality is what Donna has just highlighted is indeed fact. There will be questions and there will be a focus on appropriate use of nuclear cardiology on the boards. This is increasingly important, and I can tell you as a recent test taker for the CT boards, it has actually crept into the CT boards also. So this is a very interesting and important issue. I think everyone is trying to improve our specialty by appropriate use of our technologies in a more cost-effective fashion. So this may seem somewhat esoteric, but number one, it's not. And number two, I hope you'll agree that in addition to passing the boards, we want to do the best job we can for the quality of our specialty and what we provide for our patients. So I think it really is critical. It is very important. And of course, I'm extremely biased on the importance of this topic. So that is my number one disclaimer. So let's sort of look at where we are. I really have no disclosures that are pertinent to this one, except that I am still a member. Could we reduce the feedback that I'm getting here? Is that better? Okay. That I am still a member of the task force for the ACC in trying to develop and appropriate use criteria as well as instruments to evaluate that. So first of all, why is all this focus on guidelines and appropriate use needed? Well, I think it is really, unless you've been an ostrich with your head in the sand, I think everyone recognizes that there's been a tremendous amount of focus on the overall growth of cardiac imaging and the emphasis towards quality in what we do. There is a lot of regional variation. In other words, certain areas are definitely performing a lot more testing than others, and this has been referenced to categorization by 100,000 patients per area, so this is indeed a phenomenon that is true. We really don't know, though, whether or not certain areas and certain practices are overutilizing, are underutilizing, or are misutilizing our technologies, including SPECT and PET. And everyone really needs some guidance. So we as the clinicians need guidance in what is the optimal performance of how we order tests, but certainly payers and patients also need to be informed about what is appropriate use of nuclear cardiology. Now, we do have a number of guidance documents, and I'm sure you're all familiar with them. Certainly, clinical practice guidelines have been developed. These usually take years to develop. They're very exhaustive. I can tell you, for example, the stable angina guidelines that are now coming forward from ACC have taken, I believe, 5 years in the making and have reference listed to the thousands of publications. So that really does sort of limit some of that, but it does specify what we should and should not do. There are performance measures that are based on clinical practice guidelines, such as the application of giving an aspirin for everyone with an acute myocardial infarction or the use of ACE inhibitors. These really say this is optimal practice, you must do this. And then along comes appropriate use criteria, which really are focused in on a different direction, which are trying to tell us on a clinically scenario-based approach that this is a test that would reasonably be performed in this particular application for this patient. So it's really a lot more in sort of in the trenches, this is the approach of what we should be doing. And there is a new metric that will be released later this year, which are called appropriate use measures, which is sort of similar to the performance measure of how we track appropriate use. And I'll show you some data that we now know is very important. So clinical practice guidelines are firmly rooted in the medical literature, are really very hard evidence-based. They're comprehensive, and they have been evaluated for the use of radionuclide imaging a number of years ago, as well as chronic stable angina, with a rather shocking update coming out in the near future. Now, these are based on categories that I think all of you are aware, the ACC-AHA categorization of class 1, class 2A, 2B, and class 3. Class 1 meaning you must do it, it's the way to go. Class 3, don't do it, there's too much harm involved. And then we have some intermediate zones where class 2A, the benefits exceed the risks. And there needs to be more studies to put it into the 1 category, but it still seems that the evidence is leaning in that direction. And 2B, where again, the benefits do exceed the risks, but it's not quite as hard. So it's not harmful, but it's not really well-founded. And then we have levels of evidence A, B, and C. A usually constituted by randomized clinical trials, and level C, where it's really sort of case reports and expert consensus opinions. Now, the 2002 data for nuclear cardiology showed that overall, for example, stress imaging, as shown here, was a class 1 level B. Now, that's a pretty strong recommendation that for an intermediate pretest probability patient, that this is indeed a good approach. And then a class 2B indication for high or low intermediate pretest probabilities with an abnormal EKG. I can tell you that the new stable angina guidelines give just about everything a class 3, class 3 meaning don't do it evaluation, except for a very high risk patient such as diabetics, which is a class 2B. So things are going to change in terms of what the practice guidelines say. There's been a lot of debate and discussion about that, and we'll save that for another day. There is overlap between how guidelines and appropriate use criteria are formed, all of which should be based on evidence, sometimes with an input of expert consensus opinion. And ideally, the appropriate use criteria are firmly rooted in clinical practice guidelines, which indeed they are. But unfortunately, practice guidelines don't dictate all of our practice, and there's a number of clinical scenarios that all of us live through on a daily basis that are simply not covered or well explained by the use of clinical practice guidelines. So clearly, while there's overlap, there are unique characteristics of both. Now, the appropriate use criteria, whenever possible, are also literature-based, as you might expect. These are developed by physicians and providers. The initial focus has been on clinical imaging, and they've now been expanded to things such as revascularization. They serve, ideally, as a way to focus our reduction of clinical cardiac imaging based on appropriate applications. In other words, rather than just decreasing the overall volume of imaging, which is what regulators really want to do, why not really try to eliminate those tests that are truly not needed, rather than just indiscriminate volume reduction? It keeps money within the system and allows for continuous quality improvement from us as well as our practices and environments. And it also helps to preserve a relationship with our patients and the providers that do the care. One thing that is very important is really it gets away from the concept of no, you can't do this. The idea is denials should not be restrictive, that we do expect in some cases that inappropriate testing may still have a role in a patient's care. It just needs to be justified perhaps a little more. But importantly, it preserves access to the tests that we know that we want to order and that we believe are important for patient care. Now, the appropriate use criteria have been developed for a number of different modalities. I won't go through them, but for nuclear cardiology, were initially developed in 2005 with an update and a revised criteria in 2009. And very importantly, at the current time, there's an active process to develop multimodality criteria, which is being spearheaded at the current time and probably will be out comparing and contrasting all of the modalities, but this is probably still about a year to a year and a half off. Now, basically, what these criteria try to do is say that when there's an appropriate indication for the application, say, of myocardial perfusion imaging, that the benefits will outweigh the risks. And the risks will include exposure to radiation, and also perhaps the risk of either misdiagnosing a patient or doing untoward revascularization. And the benefits clearly are to guide medical therapies. An inappropriate study, obviously, this teeter-totter is in the wrong directions, and therefore the test should not be performed. Now, this is an interesting curve. This shows the overall volume of myocardial perfusion imaging, and especially focusing in over the last 5 or 6 years, as you can see. And we see the continued growth of nuclear cardiology up until about 2006, and then perhaps a little bit of change. And it's interesting to note that appropriateness criteria sort of came in this area, and some people would say that's bad, but overall, are we now practicing in a more optimal fashion? And if so, that would be good. So how do these work? Basically, it's a hierarchy of indications. And it's not like just pick the one that works the best and therefore gets you reimbursement. It's the idea that a patient does have various characteristics which would help to define whether or not a test is indeed appropriate. So the way the hierarchy is set up is the first question, just very simply, is this being done or are you considering ordering a test for preoperative circumstances? And if so, then there's a direction. If the answer is no, was there a recent acute coronary syndrome or recent revascularization? If there was revascularization, then there's a separate table for that. And as you can see, the way this works is that eventually if you go through and all of these are no, then you get down and ask the question, is the patient having chest pain? It's important to know whether or not they've been revascularized first, so that's why this is a higher level and a different table. What if they're asymptomatic? They could be asymptomatic, but if they've had revascularization, that's a different type of patient. So as you can see, some of the computer programmers in the audience are probably saying, well, this is a nice tree to build an algorithm, and indeed, that's why this was developed this way, and it's very now easily facilitates the use of clinical decision support tools. So this would be one such table. This is for patients with suspected coronary artery disease. They're having symptoms. We believe it's an ischemic equivalent, which can be defined even including somewhat atypical chest pain, dyspnea, or perhaps even new ECG findings would all be defined as an ischemic equivalent. If they're low probability based on their clinical risk assessment, and they have an interpretable EKG and they can exercise, it's inappropriate to do myocardial perfusion imaging. But if they have an uninterpretable EKG, then imaging is needed and it would be considered appropriate to do myocardial perfusion imaging. Likewise, if they have an intermediate or high probability of coronary artery disease and they're having symptomatology, it would indeed be appropriate to consider myocardial perfusion imaging. Now, as you can see, when we know prior test results, things change a little bit, and I'm not going to go through all of these tables, but for the most part, if you know it was a normal study and they're low risk, don't do another one. If they're at intermediate risk and it's been more than 2 years, then maybe it's okay, and we get into that sort of gray zone of an uncertain patient. Likewise, even if it's an abnormal study, we still don't have good guidance because we don't have a lot of literature. But if it's a recently performed test, such as within the past 2 years, it's not appropriate to repeat this in the presence of stable symptoms or an asymptomatic patient. Now, that changes when we have worsening symptoms or new onset of symptoms, in which case, if the study was abnormal, then it is indeed appropriate to repeat that study. However, if the study was normal previously, now we're a little uncertain, and I would say, you know, again, this is potentially a reimbursable category, but again, as you can see, this is a way that we're trying to define this, and I can tell you almost on a daily basis, we're getting more and more literature to either support or refute these types of applications. Likewise, with prior revascularization, is it indeed appropriate to do a test? If they're symptomatic, yes. It doesn't matter what the circumstances, if they have recurrence of symptoms, it's appropriate to do the test. But as we go down the tree in an asymptomatic individual, now it depends on whether it was a PCI or bypass operation. If it was a PCI less than 2 years ago and they're asymptomatic, don't do that. And I believe Hartford Hospital has an abstract delineating this very nicely to show that it is inappropriate to do this in an asymptomatic patient. For bypass surgery, the cutoff is about 5 years based on some medical literature. Clearly, even if they're asymptomatic, it would be appropriate 5 years after bypass surgery. What about for preoperative assessments? And I think these are all common scenarios that you've heard about and we've learned through clinical practice guidelines. Well, here we've sort of spun this around a little bit, but if you know the type of surgery, which if you're getting a referral for some sort of preoperative evaluation, you know what the surgery is. If the surgery is low risk, it's inappropriate to do any testing, period. Okay, it will always come out that way. If it's intermediate or high risk surgery and they have none of these risk factors, including heart failure, presence of prior coronary disease, insulin requiring diabetes, etc., then again, it's inappropriate. Or if they have a good functional capacity, even if they have risk factors, it's inappropriate. So it's really a rather small subgroup. And again, we can improve our practice by following these guidelines. Now, again, not every scenario fits into this, but these are basic guidelines. And again, inappropriate categorization is never felt to need to be zero. And we do emphasize that over and over again. Now, how do these all compare? We talk about nuclear cardiology. Where does it come out with CT and stress echo and other modalities? And I'm not going to go through all this, but I think you can tell from the colors, this is for preoperative evaluation of surgery without active cardiac conditions. We have radionuclide imaging, echo, CT, and MR. And for the most part, you can see there's a lot of red, meaning inappropriate studies, and it crosses each of these modalities. There may be some minor differences here, green to representing appropriate and yellow is uncertain, but again, basic overall, there's concordance. So again, I think all of the imaging modalities will fall into the basic categories as we've shown. Now, what's the impact of these appropriate use criteria? Again, we've highlighted that this may allow for partnerships among patients, payers, and practitioners. I think it's important. It teaches us about our practice. If you know you're performing inappropriate studies for certain indications, maybe you'll reevaluate your practice habits. It clearly drives testing based on clinical practice, not the fact that you have a gamma camera in the next room. Hopefully, we'll facilitate reimbursement when appropriate, and it will allow us to say, yes, we're prepared to give additional documentation when it's inappropriate. And the idea here is to improve and optimize care and do a better job from a cost effectiveness. Now, it's not perfect. There are still logistical issues. They're still not substitute for sound clinical judgment. These are not out to replace you as the clinician, but they're here for guidance. They should not be providing information about how to do the procedures, such as you've been hearing throughout the course of this meeting, and they're not perfect for sure. We need to go beyond just the construction of appropriate use criteria or guidelines and put them in the hands of how are we doing and how can we improve. So we want to have some tools, either at the point of service in the laboratory or at the point of order in the clinic, to define how we do. And this requires some innovations, and I think we're now starting to see this happen. Now, there have been a number of studies that have been published which have evaluated how we use our SPECT and PET imaging, and overall, there are some consistencies here. Now, these reflect all of the published literature and peer-reviewed abstracts, and I think overall, as you can see here in this category, inappropriate testing, for the most part, most of the studies are in the 10 to 15% range, and that seems to be about the threshold that we anticipate and we keep emphasizing to payers and to regulators, that roughly 10 or 15% of the studies are going to be outliers and would deemed inappropriate, and that's okay. But when it starts to fall into 20 or 25%, perhaps there's some misunderstanding about how to apply these tests for specific clinical indications, and maybe we can do a better job in those particular environments. Now, we undertook a multi-center trial about it a couple of years ago in conjunction with one of the major health plans to look to see if this was feasible in a normal workflow, and the answer was yes. And we were able to categorize most studies, 71% as appropriate, and again, about that sort of same barometer of 14% inappropriate. But I think what was notable from this approach was we were able to identify what are our targets for improved performance. For example, in an inappropriate indication, the detection of coronary disease in an asymptomatic patient who's at low risk for coronary heart disease, that constituted 45% of all the inappropriate testing in this study of almost 6,000 patients. And if we were able to eliminate that one diagnostic category, we would decrease the overall volume by 6%, which makes a lot of people happy that are paying for it, but it also preserves access to the test for the people who need it. So we're really focusing a bullet. If we just look at these five indications, such as performing SPECT imaging in a patient within 2 years after angioplasty, even though they're asymptomatic, just as a routine follow-up, and other things such as preoperative assessment in a low-risk surgical population, that constitutes, for these five indications, 92% of all inappropriate testing. And by eliminating those, we will decrease the overall testing volume about 12%. Recent summits at the White House and discussions with ACC and ASNC leadership, we clearly have to do a better job in how we do this. You know, we all know the issues of healthcare finance, but wouldn't it be nice if we could have a reduction and save some money while still having appropriate testing being performed? And that's the focus here. And obviously, the idea is we are the controllers of this rather than third party, such as radiology benefits managers, which I think everyone in the room would agree is not the best solution. Now, who's the problem? Where is the problem? The problem's everywhere. You know, a lot of times we in the press and in some of the regulators say, well, it's those cardiologists that are simply ordering inappropriate tests and it's self-referral. The reality is there's a lot of indications now suggesting otherwise. This particular comparison shows here that there's actually more inappropriate testing when referred from a non-cardiologist than actually being referred from a cardiologist. Now, it's not huge, but again, suggests that self-referral is not the only driving force here in inappropriate testing. Now, are there differences perhaps in genders and in different ethnicities? And we're starting to get some information about this now. This was a very interesting study that basically did gender reversal, where they kept all of the risk factors in each population the same, except they categorized patients first as initially categorized based on gender, and then flipped the gender, and basically showed that if you sort of designated that individual as a woman versus a man, there seemed to be more inappropriate testing. So, this gender analysis is very important and suggests there still is some gender bias ongoing, and this is consistent with several other studies that have been published. Now, we have recently updated and reevaluated the criteria, and this is a study, one of the first, looking at the new 2009 criteria, and again shows that you can do it, and very importantly, the uncategorizable group, the unclassified, has really dropped to about 3%, and it used to be about 10 to 15%. So these are much more comprehensive, and again showed the same types of problems, preoperative assessment in a low-risk cohort, low probability of patients that are able to exercise, the asymptomatic patient. This is what constitutes the bulk of these inappropriate studies. Now, this study, again, was done actually in Singapore, so this translates not only in the U.S., but to other areas, and I think, again, shows that we can indeed follow our performance. Now, there have been changes in the criteria, as this study shows, and overall we do eliminate nearly eliminate the unclassified studies, and this study from the Mayo Clinic suggests that we have gotten better at these types of criteria development. Can I go back one slide, please? Okay, this was a very interesting study. I just want to highlight because I think it shows where some of our problems are. This looked at stress testing and myocardial perfusion imaging after revascularization. This got a lot of attention in the press, and this was developed on the Medicare database standards of about 28,000 patients. And what it showed was there was a very high frequency of post-procedural stress testing, 39% at 1 year, 60% at 2 years, and a lot of clustering at these various landmarks, suggesting perhaps that routine testing was being done and orchestrated through an office visit. SPECT imaging was not surprisingly the most common study performed after patients were revascularized. And overall, this seemed to exceed the rate of historical reoccurrence of angina itself. In other words, if angina comes back in about 20% of the patients, well, then why are we stress testing them in 60%? And this led to a lot of additional procedures later on with very infrequent subsequent revascularization. So something is not quite right here, and we're starting to get the idea that maybe we're doing inappropriate testing. And indeed, Dr. Beller said it very well in an editorial that it seems like we're doing too much too soon, that we need more diligence and advised adherence to the appropriate use criteria, again, based on the literature, and that we need to be willing to alter our utilization patterns, reduce applications, again, in order to preserve this and remove some of the scrutiny that's going on from regulatory agencies and from radiology benefits managers. Now, can we do better? The answer is, I think we can. There's a number of errors that show this, that we can potentially reduce inappropriate testing from 14% to 7% as shown here. Now, maybe this is just enhanced knowledge of the appropriate use. Maybe it's because of educational initiatives. Maybe it's because of focused initiatives. Unfortunately, I'd love to say this is the standard, that we always improve, but we've now seen some recent data that suggests perhaps that we don't. We need to do some other things. I think really in order to improve what we do, we have to have a multifactorial approach. And this was suggested in Dr. Gibbons' paper where it actually showed that education did not improve optimization of appropriate applications. And there was suggestions that we need to do things such as newsletters, grand rounds, speak to our administrators, have focused meetings with our referring physicians, and then focus our educational initiatives on the key areas where we believe inappropriate applications occur. Unfortunately, in this trial, there was no impact on the inappropriate utilization rates. And this was indeed very disappointing. We've also seen this in a number of other papers and environments and suggest we need to really enhance what we do in terms of getting the message out. So there's inconsistent results. But I think the conclusions are we need a multifactorial approach. And me standing here today with you is one approach, but not necessarily the best one. We need continued feedback and continued way to do things. And one of the alternative ways is through learning communities. And there's an ACC website called Focus, which may help you. And the idea here is to reduce the geographic variation and to eliminate unnecessary or inappropriate testing, or at least reduce it by 15% in the first year and 50% within 3 years. Now, these numbers actually were presented to the White House, and these were the targets of what we, as the community of cardiac imagers, wanted to achieve, a 50% reduction of inappropriate testing within 3 years. Now, is that achievable? And again, through learning initiatives and tracking performance, that was what we intended. The Focus learning community now, as you can see, is scattered throughout the United States, and actually we now have some international sites. And the purpose here is to provide a non-confrontational information, to also be a source for information for your laboratory to tell your referring physicians about what all this is about, and to potentially give your laboratory a competitive advantage and demonstrate appropriate use, which may be important also for laboratory accreditation. Now, the good news, and this is these are unpublished data, they were presented about 3 months ago, and it's very exciting, is it now appears, and this is again involving about 40,000 patients across the United States, that going from the initial stages of here, do the best you can, track what you're doing, the 10% inappropriate rate, it now appears down to 5%. So this constitutes a 50% reduction in overall inappropriate testing, and guess what? It's only a year. So this is really showing and exceeding our expectations that we can do better, and this really puts us in a very good frame of mind. So now this is not all laboratories, but certainly a very large number that were willing to participate in this learning community. There's a number of other ways to do this too. Obviously, everyone is walking around with this particular device or something similar. What about if we had point of service where you really have the information at your fingertips, that you can look up categories and review algorithms and have clinical decision support embedded in your order entry systems? You can also track this with registries, which is good for continuous quality improvement, as well as I mentioned for accreditation. And it provides for feedback, because I don't think any of us knowingly or wantingly want to exceed and perform inappropriate testing. So what we need is more knowledge, more data, so that we can do a better job. So in conclusion, unfortunately, I think utilization management is going to continue. We're going to see this. We're going to have radiology benefits managers or some such construct for a number of years going forward. I think, however, we have to take ownership of this. We have to take responsibility for all aspects of imaging, not only doing the best quality in terms of producing the imaging, but making sure we order the right test for the right patient at the right time. The emphasis must be on quality, and we have to work, fortunately or unfortunately, with our policymakers to make this happen, that we really clearly are not trying to do harm. I think we're trying to do benefit, but we have to resonate this in the current environment very carefully. And we recognize and we're encouraging to say that inappropriate rates will never be zero in the same way that appendectomy rates of having no appendicitis will ever be zero either. Guidance documents, I believe, help. You know, again, we want to have consistency among guidelines and appropriate use criteria, but I think appropriate use criteria really for common practice and tracking performance are the key documents that we must use, and that we have to keep in mind that clinical judgment still prevails. Appropriate use criteria and other metrics really are the foundation, I believe, going forward for high-quality cardiac imaging, that these really have been developed to provide this guidance, but the implementation and evaluation really must now go forward. It's not just enough to develop these criteria. We have to take them to the next level. And I think clearly if we do a good job and we continue the process, as we've shown, to do more appropriate imaging and to watch sort of that we as the foxes are watching the hen house rather than someone else, I think clearly, potentially, we remove some of the more onerous regulatory environments, including radiology benefits managers, who are there really telling us what to do and taking it at the hands out of the clinician. Thank you very much for your attention, and good luck with your examinations.